Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Ellis. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court. The military judge abused his discretion in allowing Dr. Brandeman to testify that Appellant had a moderate high risk of reoffending over the next 15 years. Dr. Brandeman admitted that a personal interview of an accused was the better practice prior to giving an expert opinion, but said that his approach was designed specifically for analyzing records. However, the problem is that he failed to conduct a proper records review in lieu of conducting a personal interview of the appellant in this case.
Is the squabble here over conducting the interview or not conducting the interview, or is it over the methodology employed?
The methodology, Your Honor, we're not saying that it's per se lacking of a factual basis, but simply because he failed to conduct a personal interview. The court's been clear that a personal interview is not required. However, those cases have also noted that the opinion was legitimate because there was a proper records review. So we're arguing that the opinion was erroneous in this matter because of what he failed to review. Not simply because of the fact.
Can I try it a different way? Is your issue with the static 99 methodology or the static 99 methodology because it didn't include an interview?
The latter, Your Honor, along with other things. We're not arguing that the static 99 approach is
important. Well, you just said the interview wasn't a per se factor. Now you seem to be backing into it. What is it?
Two things, Your Honor.
Is it the static 99 methodology, which is the question I was asking?
Yes, Your Honor. It is the methodology that he used in this particular case. We're not saying that it's invalid simply because he failed to conduct a personal interview. The fact that he lacked a factual basis in this case is important because what he testified to in sentencing is loaded with potential prejudice, the future dangerousness of the accused.
What do you do about the extensive stipulation of fact in this case? This is an unusual stipulation. It is as detailed as any I've ever seen, and it's almost like an encyclopedia of this guy's, you know, actions during this time period. Normally we wouldn't see that, but this is,
it's
significant.
However, what the stipulation of fact really did in this case is simply give the expert insight into the general nature and severity of the offenses.
And the conduct of the accused.
Correct, Your Honor. And we don't dispute that the stipulation of fact had detail in it, but the detail really went to the nature and severity of the offense, and an expert cannot base their opinion primarily on that. I mean, he also reviewed the charge sheet. He reviewed the chat logs and a portion of the OSI special investigation report. But what he didn't review was the personnel records of the accused and the medical records, things that this court has indicated are important to review, at least in prior decisions of this court, when noting that a personal interview was not conducted. They always fall back to say, well, there was a proper records review conducted. A stipulation of fact is not enough, Your Honor. Although a personal interview of the accused is not required, experts do not have the green light to give opinions without a meaningful records review. A proper records review ensures that the expert has knowledge of his background, his character, his performance of duty, his moral fiber, and his potential and determination for rehabilitation. Those things are not contained in the stipulation of fact. So in that way, the expert is going to give a relevant opinion relating to an accused's personal circumstances. The information Dr. Brandeman reviewed may have given him, as I said earlier, a general understanding of the crime and its elements, for example, the charge sheet, the stip of fact, the chat logs. But this minimal review did not provide him with an adequate basis to render an expert opinion that this particular individual was a danger to society and presented a substantial risk of reoffense over the next 15 years. The role of the expert witness is to provide, to impart a special insight into the appellant's personal circumstances. In this case, he simply reviewed general information. And when an expert doesn't conduct a personal interview, it's really important that the records review be sufficient and complete in order to have a factual basis.
So, what specific deficiencies in the records review would you like us to focus on?
fact that he had not conducted a review of the personnel records or a review of his medical records.
And what would they get from the personnel records that would be important to this?
Certainly his performance of duty, even his EPRs, and personnel records are certainly important in this case, as in any case, because in sentencing, that's one of the things trial counsel can present. The personal records would have showed that he was an excellent performer.
That could go to mitigation, but how does it go to potential for recidivism?
Well, it goes to the expert having a factual foundation so that he can give an opinion based on the accused's personal set of circumstances. The RCM speaks of that relevant information that expert should consider is based on his character, performance of duty. The personal records are going to show character, performance of duty. In this case, it's pretty clear he had an excellent record. Even in sentencing, the senior master sergeant noted that he was in the top 5% of staff sergeants that he'd ever worked with. This is a senior master sergeant who's been in for a long time. So certainly having a factual foundation about this personal accused, this individual accused, is relevant for the expert to give necessary prior to experts giving an opinion.
Well, I guess the question that I have with respect to that is, where do we look to find the fact that this particular information that you're talking about has any bearing on recidivism, which is, I think, the question that Judge Urban was asking. I mean, I understand that those are factors that should be considered for sentencing, right, by the military judge, but with respect to this expert's opinion, what source document can you point us to that suggests that it has bearing on recidivism for child sexual abuse?
I can't point to a specific document or line within a document that would point directly to an issue of whether he is likely to reoffend in the next 15 years. All I can do is point this court to prior decisions where the court noted that personnel records were important and that the expert failed to review them, like in Mapplemy. The court didn't say, well, we're going to open up the personal records and we find that this is relevant to recidivism and this and that. They just said, you didn't review it. Your opinion's not sufficient. The expert's opinion was lacking in a factual foundation.
Did the deficiency that you've pointed out with respect to review of personnel records in any way violate a protocol with regard to the STAC 99 test?
That's unclear, Your Honor. All I can do is point this court to his testimony where he said that his opinion was designed specifically for the purpose of analyzing records. He never said that I have to review personal records or that I don't.
But in terms of what the static 99 protocol is, was that in the record or at all an issue in this case?
No, Your Honor.
No. And you also mentioned medical records. And so what in the medical records was not reviewed that would be pertinent in this case to show that the expert did not follow a proper procedure?
I can't point to anything in the medical records specifically, Your Honor. All I can do is go back to McElhaney, where the court noted you failed to conduct a review of the personnel records and you failed to conduct a review of the medical records and it was deemed insufficient, but I can't point to anything in there.
There's nothing in there that would prejudice? Why should we then rely on absence of review of the medical record? I understand your cite to McElhaney. There are other things going on in McElhaney which may or may not be pertinent, but under Article 59, we need to see prejudice with respect to any particular error. So let's assume that he didn't review the medical records. Don't we have to then consider whether there's anything in the medical records that would bear on this case?
I would disagree, Your Honor, that the defense would need to show what would have been in his medical records in order to establish prejudice under Article 59. The court's clear that if there is error, that the test for prejudice is a four-part test under Thompson, which is the strength of the government's case, strength of the defense case, the materiality of the evidence in question, and the quality of the evidence in question.
Well, if the medical records only show he showed up to the Air Force and had a physical and he hasn't been to a doctor since then, why would that be pertinent in this case? It might be, but it's a question, not a statement on my part. I'm trying to figure out why you would find prejudice there. What would have informed the expert from that review of the medical records with respect to the opinion that he offered?
I can't point to anything specifically in the medical record, Your Honor.
Counsel, I think you said earlier, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're not challenging the application of the static 99 test itself. And yet in your brief, you made an argument that the fifth criteria, the number of charges, could be or was in this case overstated to the prejudice of your defendant. Is that an argument you're continuing to make?
Correct, Your Honor. What I'm arguing is that even if the expert, even if this court decides that the expert did have a factual basis for his opinion, then under 403, that it should have been excluded because of the fact that he was relying primarily on the how the specifications were charged out, whether it was charged in diver's use or individual specifications. So in that sense, yes.
But wouldn't those charges then be subject to a multiplicious motion or unreasonable multiplication of charges if, in fact, they had been crafted in such a way that they would only add to the weight of criteria 5, they should be susceptible to a motion like that?
They could be susceptible, Your Honor, whether the motion would carry the day is another matter.
And was such a motion made in this case?
No, not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, no.
To what extent does it matter to your argument that this is a judge-alone case?
Certainly the court has noted that in a judge-alone case, sometimes the risk for prejudice is less. The fact is that even though it was a judge-alone case, Dr. Brandman was the only sentencing witness. So I'd argue that kind of offsets the fact that it was a judge-alone case. He was the only sentencing witness. There was no other aggravation evidence presented in sentencing. And obviously the trial counsel was relying on Dr. Brandman to deliver the knockout punch in this case.
Going back to the number of charges, let's assume that that it's not necessary to make a multiplicity or an unreasonable multiplication of charges argument to attack the validity of either a test or the expert's application of a test. In what way at trial did the defense attack the expert testimony based upon the number of charges in the case?
The defense counsel did cross-examine the expert on that, Your Honor. So that was out in the open. The problem is that the military judge failed to conduct a 403 balancing test on the record. So we don't know how the military judge considered the evidence, despite the fact that the defense attorney did cross-examine the expert.
I understand the cross-examination, but did the defense contend that the static 99 test was invalid because it was based upon prosecutorial discretion rather than based upon scientific evaluation of stable facts?
The defense attorney did, if I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, the defense attorney did specifically bring up the issue about how the expert's opinion being based on the fact of it was charged broken out individually versus diver's use.
Right, but did the defense do that to ask the judge to consider it in weighing the test, or did the defense do that in order to get the judge to rule that either the test or the expert's testimony in the test was invalid?
I believe that was an argument about weighing, Your Honor. That was after, when the defense counsel originally objected, he said, Your Honor, we object because he hasn't conducted a personal interview. And then further along, he added, well, also he hasn't conducted sufficient records, a review of sufficient records. And then the military judge overruled the objection, and then as the direct cross-examination continued, the defense counsel did bring up the fact that the expert's opinion was based primarily on the fact of how the charges were broken out. While he argued weighing at that time, that's pretty much all he had to argue. He couldn't argue that there was.
Why not? Why not? Why couldn't he have argued that it's an invalid test if it's based upon the decision the prosecutors make rather than based upon the behavior of the person being examined or evaluated?
I think after the military judge made his ruling that the testimony was admissible, he simply argued what he could, which was basically going to wait. But certainly our argument is that even if the expert opinion, that even if the expert had a factual basis for his opinion, the fact that the expert bases his opinion primarily on the on how the charges were broken out, that that makes
it. Isn't the whole thing waived? Isn't that whole argument waived? There was no objection. There was no objection on multiplicity grounds. There was no objection at all. How's that before us?
I don't believe it's waived at all, Your Honor. The defense counsel repeatedly objected to the...
He objected to the fact that he didn't conduct a records review. He objected to what else?
The fact that a personal interview of the accused wasn't conducted.
Right, but I see no objection to the ultimate methodology or whether the methodology in conjunction with the charging decision made a difference. So, isn't that waived?
He didn't specifically stand up and say, Your Honor, I also object because of the fact that he's relying primarily on how the charges are broken out, but he certainly argued it during the case. I would disagree that if it is waived, it's error under plain error test. That would be the defense position on appeal. If a commander cannot base his opinion on rehab potential, based primarily on the nature and severity of the charged offenses, an expert's opinion based largely on the same subject matter should not, or should be given little weight, or no probative weight by this court. And again, as stated earlier, the military judge failed to conduct any form of rebalancing tests on the record. So although there was cross-examination of the expert, and although this is a military judge alone trial, that comes down to, you know, we don't know how the military judge used this evidence in coming up with his opinion. And it's not a situation where we had a light sentence, it was a substantial confinement and a disarmed discharge.
What was the maximum potential sentence in this case?
57 years, Your Honor.
And the government asked for 15 years,
right,
and he got 11 years.
Correct.
So where is the prejudice?
It's still prejudice because he was the only defense witness called during sentencing. Again, I'm going to go back to the four factors. The strength of the government's case. There's no question that the government had a strong case. But the defense had a good case. When a senior master sergeant comes out and says, you're top 5% of the staff sergeants I've ever known, and you look at his EPRs, you look at the fact that he pled guilty, you look at the fact that no specific aggravation evidence was presented in sentencing, the fact that Dr. Branham was the only witness to testify, and the fact that trial counsel specifically... I see that over time, Your Honor.
You can take the time to answer Judge Erdman's question.
The fact that the trial counsel specifically mentioned Dr. Branham's testimony and relied on it during argument, that makes it prejudicial, Your Honor.
Thank you,
counsel. And you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Major Coretta Gray, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy Weber, represent the United States in this matter. The military judge did not err in ruling that the government's expert could testify in sentencing about appellant's risk of reoffending. Dr. Brenneman was qualified as an expert. His testimony was in the limits of his expertise. His testimony was based on a sufficient factual basis, stemming from his review of the records and use of the Static 99 risk appraisal approach. And any concern about prejudice from Dr. Brenneman's use of the form of the charge sheet was overcome by effective cross-examination by defense counsel. The Air Force Court appropriately found that the relevance of the testimony outweighed the potential for unfair prejudice.
How do we know that finding was made?
I'm sorry,
how do we know that that balancing finding was made?
Well, in this case, when the objection initially came up, the defense counsel's objection was based on 403. And he said, Your Honor, if you do determine that it is relevant based on the lack of factual basis, our position would be that any relevance that Dr. Brenneman's opinion might have on this matter is outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice to Sergeant Ellis. Well, in getting that objection, then the military judge, first of all, went over with the defense counsel that Rule 1001 of the RCM permits testimony on rehab potential. that Rule 702 allows testimony by experts on this specialized information. The judge noted that the defense counsel acknowledged that a qualified expert could testify in the form of opinion based on sufficient facts and data. And then the military judge turned to trial counsel and asked, was Dr. Brenneman expected to apply the principles and methods that he discussed to the facts in the appellant's case? And trial counsel said that yes, he intended to have Dr. Brenneman go through the 10 recidivism risk factors with the static 99 methodology. Then the military judge concluded under Amador and Stinson that it was permitted for the trial counsel to elicit an opinion on recidivism. And he said with regards to the three prongs to counsel, I'm going to allow trial counsel to continue to lay the foundation for an opinion by Dr. Brenneman. Then trial counsel had Dr. Brenneman walk through the 10 risk factors, and at the conclusion, Dr. Brenneman testified about his opinion about this high, moderate, and moderately high rate. So, yes, while the military judge did not particularly spell out, I am doing my 403 analysis on the record, much like one judge has said before, 403 is not a brooding omnipresence in the sky. We can see from this analysis that the military judge was basically doing the analysis, and so if anything, he should only be given less deference, not no deference.
Where did the military judge say your objection is overruled?
Where did the military judge say?
Did the judge ever rule on the defense objection? I'm not asking about the 403 balancing.
Right.
Asking about a ruling on the objection.
He did not. They basically moved on. He went on through that process that I described. And then at the end of that, the defense counsel had their chance for cross-examination. Of course, he re-raised some issues. But he did not.
What are we supposed to make of that? We've got a case in which there's no balancing on the record and there's not even a ruling on the record.
Well, again, even though there's not a specific enunciation that this is my 403 balancing test or an analysis, the analysis really is there with the questions that the judge is asking, with the back and forth that he has with trial counsel, defense counsel, and the conversation he has with Dr. Brenneman, the process that he has the counsel go through.
It's often said in oral argument that no one should take away from the questions that a judge asks what the opinion is of the judge on that point. Sometimes the judge will ask a question and a direction that's completely different from the way that judge might rule. Why is the trial judge's situation here any different?
Well, here the trial judge, what the trial judge did was basically go through the analysis, allow Dr. Brenneman to enunciate how his information fit and how he used the static 99. He allowed the defense counsel to do their cross-examination, which brought out important factors about the limitations on the static 99. It does not appear that the judge did anything other than do the analysis that he would be required to do. He just didn't do a good job of enunciating it on the record.
What are we to make of the fact that after the initial defense objection was raised and there was a lot of discussion and there was a recess that the military judge came back and asked the defense counsel to, what's your objection? And when asked to do that, the objection that was raised was completely different. It was not a 403 objection.
Right, and that is true. The objection, the defense counsel didn't go back and repeat his 403 objection. I think he did remain steady on his initial idea that Dr. Brenneman should have interviewed his client, and he remained steady on his initial idea that Dr. Brenneman didn't have sufficient facts to make this opinion. Then he at least acknowledged the case law that said there is no requirement for this interview, and obviously there are limitations there with the government's counsel's ability to talk to the appellant. But in general, I would suggest that part three of that Stinson test, you got one, was the witness qualified as an expert, two, was the testimony within the limits of their expertise, and then three, were there sufficient facts with which to make that opinion, that really part three is sort of that 403 prong. It is, if you had members there and this judge was doing a gatekeeping function, he would be looking at, has this expert done enough? Has he seen enough? Has he read enough? Has he done enough review to be able to state these facts for me to make sure that the right information is before the members? So although, again, the counsel sort of changed his objection, at the end of the day, it was really the same objection. And really, all of this goes to weight, not admissibility. I mean, the military judge is a judge, and he's hearing this case. It's a judge-alone case. The defense counsel did a great job in their cross-examination.
So does that mean you're arguing that if members had this case, there would have been error?
Oh, no, Your Honor. Not at all. What we're just saying is that we can take the facts that we have here and see that in a judge-alone case, especially, there should be no concern. When this judge is doing the analysis...
Is the government's position that static 99 is adequate to meet the requirements of 1001B5B
yes,
on its own?
Yes, Your Honor. It's been peer-reviewed. It's been peer-tested.
So this case should stand for the proposition that a witness only reporting on static 99 would qualify as sufficient information and knowledge about the accused to offer a rationally based opinion?
Well, this is not a witness who's only testifying regarding static 99.
No, but that my question was, would static 99 be enough?
Well, I think what we have here is a case where the static 99 methodology, which has been peer-reviewed and approved, is one that helps.
Right. My question is it the government's position or not that static 99 alone would qualify under 1001?
That is not the government's position. What the government...
So it takes something more than static 99 to be admissible in a military court-martial?
It takes...
In the government's view?
It takes sufficient facts, whatever that may be. So as we've seen in those other cases that were cited by the defense and that we also talked about in our briefs, sometimes the facts may just be someone's drug rehabilitation record, and that's sufficient. In other cases, it may be an interview with the victim, an interview with the appellant, review of all kinds of records.
And just so I get it right, the plus up here, there's the static 99 plus, and just to make sure, so and then the appellant can indicate whether he agrees with your catalog or not, what's the plus?
The plus is the care inquiry, the 17-page stipulation of fact, the analysis of the hard drive and the images, the chat logs, the charges and specifications, and the discussion with the Cannon Air Force Base officials about rehab options for Air Force inmates. All of that together is more than enough sufficient facts to make the opinion that Dr. Brandeman did in this case. And as it was also pointed out or brought out, the defense really hasn't pointed to what would have made a difference in mental health records, of which, in the again, the excellent cross-examination by the defense counsel, does not point to. And so, Dr. Brandeman, you're a forensic psychologist. Why didn't you look at mental health records? Obviously, shouldn't that make a difference? There are no specific medical records or even specific personnel records that the defense is pointing to that would make a difference in this opinion about recidivism. As a matter of fact, if you look at the static 99 testing, and even if you have this issue, which was not objected to and no motions were made about the charge sheet or multiplicity or unreasonable multiplication of charges, but even if you took best case scenario for the defense and compounded several of the charges together, you would still likely come out with the number 6 for the static 99 testing that had to do with charges. And that would still put the appellant in the same position at a 38% recidivism rate that he was in with the score that he did have.
Is that your analysis of the static 99 or the expert's analysis?
That's based on the expert's description of how he filled in the static 99 methodology.
But in terms of breaking down the charges?
Oh, no, the expert did not do that. That's the government's analysis, even if we're you know, giving a lot of room to the defense of what they might combine. He would have still, based on charges, if you have 6+, he would have still gotten a 3 based on our analysis of how that would work, trying to be generous to the defense about what you could combine. So again, that would not change.
Has any Article 3 court or state Supreme Court given an opinion as to the validity of the static 99 test and the use of that in a court with respect to likelihood of recidivism?
I am not aware of any, Your Honor, but I have not fully researched that, and so I would want to get back to you on that.
You might want to take a look at the Seventh Circuit opinion in a case called McIlrath, M-C-I-I-L-R-A-T-H, 512 F-3rd, 421, recent opinion by Judge Posner, in which he raised some questions about the Stack 99 and its use. My question is, in any case, in the military justice system where we have an adversarial procedure for sentencing rather than the use of sentencing reports and the less formal procedures that are used in many other jurisdictions, why should an expert be allowed to give an opinion which is based on the charging decisions of prosecutors? I understand your argument that that may or may not have made a difference in this particular case, but why should that test have be considered to have any validity at all in making a presentation? And the second part of that question is, assuming that it has some validity, why isn't it particularly important in that context for the judge to place the 403 balancing test on the record? So that's a two-part question. Why does it have any validity? And then if it does, why isn't it particularly important in that context to have 403 balancing on the record?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, as to the first part about why should an expert be able to do this, I think two things. One, the defense has the rigorous cross-examination with which to point out any issues, problems, or things that they would like the court to consider about the limitations of the government's expert. Two, the defense here had their own expert and had the ability to put up their own expert to refute, rebut, correct, or give an opinion about the limitations of what the government's expert is saying. Between those two things, the defense's right to have an expert and their cross-examination, I believe that would take care of the problem or the concern that somehow this is skewed greatly by prosecutorial discretion in charging. In addition, in part two, why is it extremely important for the defense, for the judge to put this on
is
the
record? Is that the rule under General Electric against Joyner or any of the Supreme Court's decisions on expert testimony, that the existence of the opportunity for cross-examination is sufficient to establish the validity of a test?
No, Your Honor. I think what I'm saying is it's not that the issue is whether the test is valid or not. Through Daubert and through the judge here in this case, with the extensive questioning with the expert about his, how many times has he testified, has this been peer-reviewed based on the journals and articles. So the issue is not that the lawyers are trying to be the forensic psychiatrists and tell them whether this is proper methodology or not. The issue is, are there things that need to be brought out about this to make sure that the court has all information that it needs to have? And that's where the cross-examination and the right to put their own witness comes into place. Always, certainly, it's important for the judge to put on the record the 403 balancing test. Here, the judge did not put his specific analysis on the record. He should have. That just means that he gets less deference, not no deference. And in this case, given everything that the military judge had to look at, and especially given the nature and the aggravation of the facts of this case in general, the 11 years that appellant received despite the government's request for more time, and despite the extreme maximum he was facing, it seems completely reasonable under the circumstances. I mean, we're talking about an appellant who was carrying on a sexual relationship with a mom and her seventh grader. He's molesting her in the parking lot of an elementary school. He's carrying on disgusting chats with her, and even when faced with an Article 32 hearing, he moves on to a second 14-year-old, or so he thought. That one just happened to be in law enforcement. And even after sitting through an Article 32 hearing, he goes back and continues the chats with a 14-year-old, asking her questions like, how big are your tits? Is your pussy bald? Why don't
now, you're arguing prejudice, or are you arguing error or no error?
I am.
That sounds like a prejudice argument.
It does go to the prejudice prong, absolutely, okay. Your Honor. But I'm saying also we can Is the issue Dr. Brandman's testimony about recidivism, or was the issue here the facts and the circumstances of this case that the military judge had to consider? And when he's considering the weight versus the admissibility, and he has all of this information that Dr. Brandman looked at, the care inquiry, the 17-page script, the images, the chat logs, the charges, the rehabilitation options, and then he only still comes up with a score, the expert only still comes up with a score of 38% recidivism rate, when it's, at least the facts tend to bear out that this particular appellant had a 100% recidivism rate.
Counsel, I want to ask a more fundamental question.
Yes, sir.
I realize, of course, that both the rule and case law permits this kind of expert testimony. Are there any limits on this kind of thing? Or is there a point at which this kind of thing invades the province of the sentencing authority and basically suborns the trial? And if so, what are those limits? I'm not saying that that exists in this case, but are there any limits on this kind of thing? And if so, what are they?
Well, I do believe that the fact that the defense can bring their own expert is probably one of the important limitations on this, because experts, they make their money, they make their standard, they make their reputation, basically by their reputation. And if they're getting up there and putting out junk science, bad information, information that's confusing or misleading, then there's another expert that can get up and say, all that that expert said is a bunch of foolishness. Don't listen to it. Let me tell you what the real deal is, and here's why.
So then it resolves into a contest of dueling experts on take a member's trial.
Sure.
Here's your members. Expert one says, this guy's going to fall off the wagon. This guy's going to do it again. Expert two says, absolutely not. Expert one is full of crap. What's the judge supposed to do in a situation like that? And aren't we going awfully far into invading the province of the members?
Well, I don't believe that the issue of dueling experts is a new issue for judges in the law.
No, certainly not in product liability and stuff like that, but that's not what we're talking about here.
Well, and even in the cases that we see where you've got, you know, both sides have their forensic psychiatrist, both sides have their, you know, serology expert or what have you, they're your analysis experts, what have you. Mm-hmm. In this case, and I think it's interesting to point out that when Dr. Brandman, who's testifying 95% of the time for the defense, when he went through the different methodologies that can be used before he decided to use Static 99, he talked about, you know, we go from almost just clinical evaluation where the expert interviews the person and based on their knowledge and experience comes up with an opinion that they determine basically is like a coin flip, to the best case scenario of this methodology that came out in 1999 with Static 99. And even that only has a 70% success rate, so to speak. All that information can come out. The judge considers that, which the judge, he was very careful in asking many questions to the expert. He took time out, took a recess, thought about it, and got input from both sides. I believe that the judges can handle this based on getting the good information brought into the courtroom, the job that counsel are doing in bringing out important points. And in this case, the defense counsel used his consultant to at least bring out proper cross-examination points. And then the judge's responsibility is to protect the members, basically, if it's a member's trial. And of course, in his own case, he should certainly put it forward.
And that's not this case.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see my time has expired.
Counsel, you can take the time you need to briefly summarize.
Thank you, Your Honor. In conclusion, the military judge did not err in ruling that the government's expert could testify during sentencing about appellant's risk of reoffending. And the government asks that this court affirm the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
When an expert testifies that his opinion would have changed based on the mere form of the charge sheet. And when he says that this variable would be a substantial difference in his opinion, a little more than 50% less chance of reoffending, and when the military judge utterly fails to conduct a 403 balancing test on the record, there is prejudicial error. And it doesn't matter that it's a judge alone case. There can be error in a judge alone case. Contrary to the government's argument, there was no quasi-balancing test on the record. The military judge merely did what any judge would do, is talk about the evidence in question, but he didn't never mention 403, never talked about balancing. Irrespective of whether this court gives it less deference or no deference, it was the wrong rule. The fact that Dr. Brandon testified 95% of the cases for the defense shows that maybe he wasn't used to testifying as a government witness and wasn't used to analyzing the static 99 and this kind of factor in this way, where he looks it all up on factor 5 based on the mere form of the charge sheet.
Are there any cases you wish to draw the court's attention to that discuss the static 99 methodology, either in federal or state court?
No, Your Honor, based on my review, I have seen a number of courts using the static 99 review, frankly. I haven't seen a court case specifically say that it's invalid or inappropriate in a sense, in case, but I have seen it used in various state courts. This court should also consider that the erroneous admission of expert testimony inherently has a higher potential for prejudice, because it is, after all, expert testimony. Because the military judge failed to conduct a 403 balancing test, again, we ask this court not to give the military judge's ruling any deference. Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. The court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.